the average program implemented well could increase learning by the equivalent of around 6 months or 9 months of school additional per year.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. Well, it's one thing to enroll kids at school, but that's just the beginning of their education. When they're there, they need to learn. And unless that starts with learning to read, we're failing in our duty to them. A new report produced by a group of literacy experts and endorsed by the Global Education Evidence Advisory Panel, GEEP, shows that improving the quality of reading instruction can sharply increase reading levels in schools in low middle-income countries, and it calls on policymakers to act on its evidence. We welcome back Benjamin Piper of the Gates Foundation, who is one of the authors. Ben, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Thanks so much, Tim.
How important is the ability to read for children?
If you think about the fundamental task of school, it's teaching children a variety of skills, but particularly and primarily and initially, the ability to read. The task eventually is for kids to be able to use reading to learn, but first they need to learn to read. The ability to read unlocks so many things, including a numeracy. I actually taught primary school myself. And unless my fourth graders could read, they couldn't do those math problems, as increasingly they became word problems. So it's the first task.
And looking at it from the other end, for a society, especially one that's economically developing, how important is it to have a population that knows how to read?
Economic growth for countries depends on it. The economic growth of sub-Saharan Africa, where I live and predominantly work, depends on it. And I think increasingly as the workforce and the educated population become more and more African and more South Asian, the whole globe's economy depends on it. I think there's no other education investment and no other economic investment can reach its potential. And it's practically the gateway to all other learning and opportunity. I've spent my career focusing on primary school, but I think the ability to have these basic skills in early grades is critical to unleash the human capital pipelines that are needed for economic growth, including via STEM. We think about numeracy as the first step to STEM, but literacy is the first step into TVET, into health sectors. These skills are the highest return investment that education systems can make.
In low middle-income countries, we know that we have been amazingly successful at getting kids into school. But how successful have we been at teaching them to read when they are there?
So we have made some progress recently, Tim, over the last 5 years, 10 years in particular.
Good, good.
That said, there was just a recent launch of PAL Network reports last week in Nairobi, where I live. I got to attend. So it's presenting results from 11 countries across low and middle income countries, but also including places like Mexico. And the results were pretty stark, Tim. If you look at the curve by which you could see whether or not kids have reached basic skills, there's some countries, just tiny increases of percentage of kids who can read at age 4, but then even up to age 10 and up to age 14. So there are many countries in sub-Saharan Africa and some in South Asia where it takes 5 years of school to get what you should get if you had good literacy instruction in 2. So this is a combination of a huge problem, but one of the unique things in education, it's a fixable one.
Yeah.
There's many other things, having spent my career in education, that are really difficult to solve, but teaching these genius children how to figure out what these funny shapes mean and read and understand it, that one we know how to do. It's possible.
But in the meantime, while we are working out exactly how to solve it, would I be exaggerating if I said that this was a crisis?
We are ignoring how big a crisis it is because, as I said, all of these countries that are worried right now about progress from secondary school into tertiary or to university or from secondary school into the workforce, why are these transitions so difficult? We think the evidence is pretty strong that a lot of those challenges that show up later in the education system are actually a problem of basic literacy and numeracy skills. The percentage of kids who are not reaching benchmarks in low and middle income countries are 70% overall. I think that's going to come down. There should be an upcoming report that shows some progress on that. I'm married into an Ethiopian family. I live in Kenya. Good friends are Indian, South Asian. Talent level is extremely high, but the outcomes for these kids on average are way too low. It's not only a crisis from a learning outcomes point of view, it's a crisis of human capital. The gap between the innate talent and the outcomes of education is just too big.
Do we know why so many children are failing to learn to read?
There's a variety of reasons, but I think this paper spends most of its time talking about a heartbreaking reason, Tim, which is a principal cause of the learning crisis on literacy is because we are applying incorrect or inefficient methods for literacy instruction. So put a different way, we could dramatically solve this problem by simply applying the evidence-based tools that we now know can work in Sub-Saharan Africa, can work in South Asia, and can work at scale. And if you're in a country that has these instructional methods and are benefiting from it, there's some real credit to you. But if you're in the neighboring country that is saying we're doing a literacy program but isn't following what this evidence says would be most efficient, I think there's some practical steps that can be done to improve outcomes.
And when you and your colleagues, you review the evidence, is there a consensus? Is the evidence settled on what works and what works in these settings in particular?
So this new paper brings together 150 studies, Tim, 170 plus languages that are included in this research. And the reason why we thought, as one of the authors, this was important was because there have been some efforts on reading over the last 10 years, but there was a criticism that maybe these were not fit for purpose. They didn't apply in Sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia.
Sure,
and that was a legitimate worry because a lot of the evidence that we referred to in the design of these reading programs was from the U.S. There was something called the National Reading Panel in the U.S. or the Rose Report in the U.K. And you would see so many literacy programs in Africa, they would cite the National Reading Panel or the Rose Report. And the question was, is that applicable in a Malawi? Is that applicable in an Ethiopia? My wife's Ethiopian. I've lived there for many years. It's a very different script, right? These are not letters.
Yes.
They're silk.
Yes, absolutely.
Right? So does the evidence that we applied from these Western context, does this work for us? And that's a question like that in some of these Southeast Asian countries that use very different scripts. So basically what we're saying in this paper, including 150 new studies, 170 plus languages, is that we now can update and have updated what the science of reading is. The science of reading has made a lot of headway in the rich world as kind of, oh, we now know how to improve reading. But I think we are taking it a step farther than that and say, okay, what is the science of reading for the globe? If we had to summarize the key areas of instructional focus that kids need, how would you change it? And the basic story is that we now know that there are six key areas and a few key methods that have the best evidence for high-quality literacy programs. Any new literacy program or any existing literacy program that wants to adapt to this evidence should look at those.
If there is evidence and that evidence is not being followed, is it because the teachers don't know the evidence, or is it because they've heard about the evidence, but they're like, I'm going to carry on doing it my way?
I'm quite a big fan of teachers. I was a teacher. My mother's a teacher. My mother-in-law was a teacher, father. So I'm a big fan of teachers, but I also know how hard that job of teaching is, particularly in the area of reading. I went to university, studied education. My first job was teaching. My professor at university was a global expert on literacy. She wrote a bunch of books. She had programs that the state of North Carolina applied. My first job, my district decided to apply one of her core methodologies. So I was very well trained, but my school didn't yet have the materials I needed to teach. So I'm a well-meaning, hardworking, well-trained teacher, and it was hard for me to do what I had been trained on because I didn't have in my hands the evidence-based methods that follow the science of reading. So I would basically say that for the vast majority of teachers not using evidence-based methods, we would see substantial improvement if we got them what they needed and put in front of the child the best set of materials.
Let's have a look at these six core areas that you pull out in the report. And the first one is to learn oral language, to learn how to speak the language. Isn't this something that children just acquire naturally?
Well, in some ways, if you break down the six areas we're going to talk about that the report emphasizes, language is different than the other five. Language skills are things that the human brain picks up naturally, and the other five, the report makes really clear, need to be taught explicitly. That said, oral language is important in a couple of areas. One, you need to have vocabulary. You might learn how to speak, but your vocabulary might be pretty simple. I'm from Cleveland, Ohio, so my vocabulary is driven by my hometown. But a lot of kids in sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia, the language they learn to read is not always the same language that they speak at home. So you need to develop those oral language skills in that L1, but also in the L2, or in some countries, L3, where you might have some ability to communicate, but might not have the complex academic language that you need and the ability to understand how oral language works. A lot of the best programs right now have really made progress on how do you develop these oral language skills over and above what we access and acquire naturally.
The next two skills are phonological awareness and systemic phonics. I was reading about those, and it occurred to me they require a more analytical ability from the teachers. Is one constraint in this that, first of all, we need to teach the teachers these methods?
Yeah, exactly. I think both phonological awareness and phonics require teachers orally to be able to separate sounds and be able to manipulate sounds. That's phonological awareness. And separate letters or syllables or something that makes a sound in the language. And that is not how the typical instruction has been happening in sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia for a long time. There's been a lot of whole word instruction. Here's the word. The teacher says the word, points to the word. The kids say the word back. Mm-hmm. And if you're as smart as Tim, maybe you can kind of decipher that, yes, the word Tim has three letters in it and each of them have an individual sound. And we need to put those sounds together to make the word Tim. But for a large percentage of kids, you actually have to have the teaching to show that T, I, M are three different sounds that come together. Phonics has been a big part of the movement in the U.S. to improve the implementation of science of reading. So a big question that we were facing before we wrote this paper is, what is it going to say about phonics? And I think it's pretty clear that this paper is trying to make it clear that evidence-based instructional programs include phonics, right? Mm-hmm. The type of phonics that it should include differs by the language specifics. But in each of these languages, there are fun, engaging activities that make it interesting for kids to be able to learn their phonic skills and be able to put the letters and syllables together, whatever the language construction is. The specifics of how to do this will differ by language. So we really want to encourage the people listening to this podcast and reading the report to make sure that we are including language experts who understand the morphology of that particular language, understand how it's coming together, and are included in the development or refinement of these programs that include phonics.
Your next core skill is reading fluently. That requires access to things to read, so books, other text for practice. Is that supply of materials a common problem?
Yeah, I think about sub-Saharan Africa, where the recent report is suggesting that, you know, you're lucky in some countries if you have a 2-to-1 child-to-textbook ratio. And the problem with that, obviously, is that a lot of countries have these oral classroom societies where the teacher asks a question and the children respond back orally. And these kids are very smart. They can respond back orally to the teacher reading without ever having their eyes accessing print. So if you have a 1-to-1 book, it gives you the ability to actually track with your finger and for the teacher in a relatively large class to be able to see, okay, Ben, you're struggling. I'm not so worried about Tim because I can see his finger is tracking where we were reading, but Ben needs some follow-up. I need to be able to have some practice on the phonics, or I need to have some more engagement. And I think this fluency practice is also the opportunity to give more text for kids that are interesting, that are fun, that give them the love of learning, the love of, you know, as a young child myself and my own children, they fell in love with books. I think kids in sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia need to also fall in love with books and stories and become authors and enjoy learning. And I think that one of the things we want to put to bed as a part of this debate on the science of reading is that good instructional programs that follow the science of reading are fun. They have access to materials that are interesting. And the point is to let this child engage with thoughts and ideas and things beyond their world. So we're really excited about how the evidence is showing that you can have materials that are affordable by countries and allow individual kids to have access to the core book, but also supplementary readers that make it easy for these kids to learn things that they'd be interested in and read things that engage their imagination.
So to round this out, the final two core areas are reading comprehension and writing. And I remember from school, if I remember correctly, you will know much better than me, that these skills that kids acquire at different paces. And it really matters sometimes to have the teacher at your elbow to be able to help you out if you're struggling. If there is a very large class size, which is inevitable in a lot of cases, does this become a problem?
Well, it definitely makes it harder. I'm thinking about my daughter, who's a first-year teacher, and she's working with special education learners in the U.S., and just the task of her 9 kids who are struggling with decoding, mm-hmm. and decoding on the one hand, but comprehension on the other, and the amount of time it takes even for that in the U.S. in a rich country is substantial. But I have seen classrooms with my own eyes, Tim, where a teacher with a class size of 70 is able to have engaging small group opportunities after the children are reading the story to talk to your neighbor, to predict what's going to happen next, to put things on the board, to have discussions at the table about what's going to happen next and laughing if they got it right or wondering what they got wrong. And I've seen some beautiful reading comprehension lessons, even in large classes. In the future, it might be possible for countries to reduce class sizes, but I do think that one of the points of the report is to make the case that in the existing system, with the existing teachers and the existing ratios, you can dramatically improve learning outcomes by doing better with these tasks. And finally, for writing, this is a new addition for this report, where writing is showing itself to have a multi-directional relationship with reading, that kids sometimes who are struggling with decoding actually learn decoding by learning to spell. And I think this is a really important contribution to this paper, that there are a range of writing skills that kids need to have, and that ability to read would help with writing, and the ability to write would help with reading. From the programs we're supporting in India, kids are writing in disposable workbooks. But in a lot of countries, what you really have is just this very simple exercise book, Tim, and just having an access with their own pencil, being able to write in it with a good teacher, with a good structured program, can really make a difference. Now, we've talked about the 6 areas. Tim, I just want to say also that the best literacy programs are ones that will put these 6 interventions in a structured program. So yes, we want the teacher to learn the complex skill of teaching phonics and teaching writing. Both of those things might be new for some teachers, but the best programs are something called structured pedagogy, which actually would give the teacher the scaffold and support to be able to teach these things in a way that will feel easy and possible for them in their local contexts.
Ben, when we're designing programs to improve reading, you were mentioning L1, L2, and L3 before. Many children grow up speaking different languages out on the street and at home and in different contexts. Should these programs be designed so that children are taught to read in their first language, even if that language is local or a minority language?
One of the main things that the evidence suggests is that yes, learning to read in the language you speak at home has a lot of benefits. It makes it the oral language acquisition much easier. It gives that grade one learner the ability to actually, if your first 3 letters that you learn are T-I-M, and you can sound out T-I-M, and you can say the word Tim, that kind of eureka moment as like a first grader in the second week of class, being able to read a word and know what it means, has real power. That said, the report is clear that there are countries that are making decisions on language and instruction policies that might not be optimal from an evidence-based point of view. The evidence is quite strong that learning to read in your first language is best, but I think there is, in the report, examples and best practices on countries who are using an L2 program or in some cases even an L3. And in all of them, you were encouraging to some extent that countries consider the language transitions. There are significant numbers of countries who are looking within primary school, whether we start in L1 or in L2, how do we build up the skills in the second language over time so that all kids can read? So there's a good bit more in the report on that. This is a country decision, but I think the evidence is quite strong that learning in your first language has real benefits.
And tell me a little bit more about the consistencies and the differences across languages, because as you point out, in Ethiopia, in India, the language looks different, it's structured different compared to the language that I've grown up with in the UK.
Well, I think that's one of the real exciting things about this report. We have authors who are literacy experts from across the world. Uh-huh. We have an Arabic experts in Southern African languages, experts in Hindi, experts in Spanish. And so we not only have the report that's considering the wide range of language types, but also we are coming up with new resources soon that would actually have language-specific tools and guidance about how to teach reading in those specific areas, and Hindi being one, Southern African languages being another, Arabic, Spanish. The ideas around these six areas of instruction that we mentioned earlier, oral language, phonological awareness, phonics, fluency, reading comprehension, and writing, those apply all six languages. The specifics, let's think about Ethiopia. I love Ethiopia. You have languages in Ethiopia that use this alpha syllabary, the Giz script. And in the neighboring region, you have ones that are using the Latin alphabet. So obviously, the ways you teach phonics would be different in those two locations. But the idea of the importance of phonics, having enough instructional time, and making sure that this is responsive to, you know, words and skills that these kids know are consistent. So I think this paper is pretty unique because it's saying that, yes, there is almost a universal set of skills that kids need, but we're also very clear and very aware that the ways that that looks in Afan Oromo in Ethiopia, which is a Latin alphabet that has extended words, in Amharic in Ethiopia would be very different. There's a lot of work that needs to be done at the country level to design and refine these programs in response to this evidence. But I think we do have a much more robust global evidence base about what should happen.
My father was a teacher as well. We should never underestimate the difference that a great teacher can make. Should we be investing more in helping our teachers, in finding new teachers as well to help solve this reading crisis?
Tim, this can work with the teachers we have. The evidence is strong that with enough support to teachers, there are programs that we recommend that have a lot of evidence called structured pedagogy. I don't love that term, but the basic idea is it provides the teacher with a scaffold. There's a lesson plan that gives each of these six learning areas on a daily basis, what you would do on a Tuesday and what you would do on a Thursday. So the teachers you have can apply these skills in the classrooms that exist. They are going to need a lot of training. This could be low-cost training, but they do need training to know what it looks like to do these things. Tim, these are basically lesson routines. There are specific things you can do. 5 to 10 mini lessons, 3 or 4 of them in one class, that would teach the kids oral language, 5-10 minutes. Teach the kids phonics, 5-10 minutes. Teach the kids to have a practice time with reading, have practice time with comprehension. And like 4 or 5 of these on a daily basis. I used to be a teacher. Those things are hard to come up with. Some of the best programs are ones that kind of provide the scaffold. Of course, we want teachers to be able to respond to the needs in their classrooms, but the vast majority of teachers benefit from having some coherent package that makes it easier for them. In Uttar Pradesh, 230 million people, it's a state. It would be maybe the 5th largest country in the world if it was a country. The percentage of kids who have basic literacy skills have doubled over the last few years.
Wow.
Doubled. And they're using this structured approach that is giving kids something that they can read and work on every day, and giving their teachers a set of materials that they can teach from to encourage them across these six areas. So it is possible to happen with the teachers you have, even in the constraints that large systems face.
You're calling on policymakers to implement national programs or large regional programs. You have given them the evidence and you have given them the scaffolding. You've taken them nearly all the way there. If they push back at you, or if your efforts fail, what are the objections that they raise?
A lot of the efforts on this at medium scale and in some countries large scale have been donor funded. The USAID played a big role. FCDO played a big role. So partners who used to fund some of these things have declined. So this is really falling more and more to governments about how do I fund this myself. The paper suggests, and I personally feel, that there is a real pathway to adopt a coherent, evidence-aligned package that would include materials for kids, lesson plan for a teacher, support, and that means coaching or teacher-level meetings for teachers, and then ongoing training for teachers. So doing a coherent package is what we recommend in the paper, not isolated one-off training. The evidence is also saying that this is affordable actually at scale. So these structured pedagogy programs can be amongst the most cost-effective investments. Governments can implement these evidence-based literacy programs for as little as $5 to $6 per student per year. That could be maybe 6 or 7 in year 1, coming down to 3, but on average, $5 per year, which is about 1% or maybe 2% of the median education budget. Given the impacts that are possible here, the average program implemented well could increase learning by the equivalent of around 6 months or 9 months of school additional per year. The evidence from Center for Global Development suggests you can get a 30-to-1 return at the societal level and at the individual level. Longitudinal studies recently are showing that you can have between 10 and 12% increased wages for kids who have these basic skills. It's a no-brainer investment.
Ben, let's hope that many policymakers are going to make that no-brainer investment. Thank you for talking about it.
Such a pleasure to be with you, and we're really excited about all the countries that have been implementing these large-scale programs and hopeful for more and hopeful for bigger impacts. Thanks, Tim.
The report is called Effective Reading Instruction in Low and Middle Income Countries, What the Evidence Shows. Authors: Alvarez Marinelli, Bogil Jones, Crawford, Dubek, Gingran, Lack, Moholwani, Oviedo, Piper, Saavedra, and Taha. It is published by Geep. This has been a Vox Dev Talk, the best way to make sure you don't miss an episode. You know what I'm going to say, subscribe. Wherever you get your podcasts, we will be there. All our past episodes, as always, are at voxdev.org, including all our past episodes about education and reading, which are all fascinating, one of which has been in it. And if you like what you're hearing, please tell someone else about us. Leave us a review as well. Vox Dev Talks is a Talk Normal production. The assistant producer is Megan Bieber, and our editor is Andrei Zargarian. Thanks to Oliver Hanni and Iman Siddiq at Vox Dev.